You're listening to the Illuminaire podcast, where we dive deep into behavioral health topics and shine a bright light on the forces shaping this industry's future. From research and technology to business and investment and more. Here's your host, Dr. Ronit Molko.
Hi, everybody. This is Dr. Ronit Molko, and welcome to this week's episode of the Illuminaire podcast. I am delighted to welcome my guest today, Harry Nelson. Harry is a healthcare legal expert and author. His books, From Obamacare to Trump Care, Why You Should Care, and The United States of Opioids, A Prescription for Liberating a Nation in Pain, have called attention to the ways in which our conversation around healthcare needs to change. Harry's day job is managing Nelson Hardiman, the largest healthcare and life sciences law firm in Los Angeles, where he has been hard at work on emerging legal issues around COVID-19 and the pandemic. Harry, I'm thrilled to be talking to you today.
Great to be with you, Ronit.
I know we're going to go into a discussion about the different drivers of healthcare, but before we do that, can you please review for our listeners the Mental Health Parity Act and the Affordable Care Act?
Sure. So I think both laws are important to understand, to really understand the moment in time in which we find ourselves in terms of the law driving change in behavioral health. The Mental Health Parity Act, the full name is the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act, was a federal law passed in 2008. And what it essentially did was it identified and set out to eliminate discrimination against behavioral health, meaning all the full range of mental health services and addiction, relative to medical and surgical care. The idea was there was a perception that the problem was that the health plans, employer-sponsored plans and other health plans were essentially treating mental health differently and applying lots of limitations to the way that behavioral health was delivered and the way that that employer plans and other health plans were responsible to provide it. And the point of the law was to eliminate it, and it gave authority to the Department of Labor to focus on that. So that was really the way I think about mental health parity is it was a negative prohibition, meaning it was supposed to end discrimination. The Affordable Care Act was much more significant because for the first time, taking effect in 2012, the Affordable Care Act was passed in 2010. But what happened in 2012 was that the definition of minimum essential health benefits that all plans were required to cover came to include mental health and addiction treatment. And so for the very first time, all plans, whether they were commercial plans, plans purchased on the insurance exchanges, government plans like Medicaid and Medicare, and employer plans were actually affirmatively required to include in their basic coverage as a minimum essential benefit, behavioral health services. So that was actually the real beginning of this affirmative obligation. And what we're seeing is that the last 10 years, or 8 years technically from the ACA implementation, has been a period of behavioral payers coming to grips and adapting to an environment in which they're required to provide the service. So we have a long way to go on the enforcement and the implementation of both laws, but they have really transformed the environment for behavioral health.
And I know we're going to be talking about how these specifically impact behavioral health, but before we do that, you've identified 5 specific drivers to healthcare. So I'd love to talk about those. The first one you identified is political. Can you help us understand your views around this?
Yeah, so I think when we think about change, you know, I think it's useful to think about how change happens in healthcare because we have a lot. It's obviously healthcare is a massive complex system with a lot of different stakeholders, you know, patients, healthcare providers, payers, drug makers and other product, device makers, regulators. And so I think it's useful to kind of think about the way that change is occurring through different sources. And I like to start with political. It was why I wrote the From Obamacare to Trump Care book, which is to say that there are a lot of the different stakeholders who have really distinct critiques of what's wrong with our healthcare system. So, you know, I think that there's some agreement that our system is broken in many respects. Notably, we spend more. When I wrote the book a couple of years ago, we were spending just under $9,000 a person. I actually, Ronit, as I was coming on the podcast, I updated my statistically. I just went to see, and we're now spending more than $11,000 per man, woman, and child in the United States for healthcare. And we have relatively mediocre outcomes. There are many, many countries in developed countries, for example, in Western Europe, that that spend a fraction of what we spend and are doing much better. Their people are living longer and living healthier lives. So everybody agrees that our system has work to do. But then when you actually go about trying to understand how it needs to be fixed, we see lots of different critiques, right? We see on the left from progressives a focus on our system being unequal, on certain people not having enough access to care, and there being a disparity in the care that wealthier people get and poorer people get. On the right, we see a real focus on cost, although you could argue that in some sense everybody agrees healthcare is too expensive. And we see other critiques of the system. And of course, other stakeholders, you know, the view looks very different. If you're a patient or a healthcare provider, if you're an insurance company or another kind of payer or a drug maker, what's broken about our system looks very different. And it's striking that this is a particularly challenging aspect of change, because from my vantage point, that, you know, I try to argue in the book that the Affordable Care Act was really a compromise, right? It was the first time in 50 years that we had a sweeping change to the healthcare system. 50 years from the point that Medicare and Medicaid had been adopted, the last previous major change in 1965, and it was really a compromise. You know, it was an attempt to kind of bring all the stakeholders together and find something that everybody could live with. Nobody was completely happy with. And what we've seen is that if you look from where we were 10 years ago to today, we've become more polarized. And certainly looking at it from a left-right perspective, both sides are unhappy with it and want to see something, want to see very, very different pictures. And it makes it that much harder to fix our system.
How do you see that changing if the Democrats win the White House in November?
So it's interesting, you know, the Democrats, the Democratic position today, if you watched the debates, it was so interesting. You know, they essentially reject the Obamacare compromise, right, in favor of something much more progressive. So, you know, the central compromise that the Affordable Care Act tried to work was that we were going to take care of the poorest Americans by expanding the Medicaid program significantly, but we were going to force the working and middle class to buy health insurance if they didn't get it from their employer. And we were going to tax health plans for people who were getting really wealthier people, or people getting rich benefit plans from employers. And so there was a little bit of give and take from everybody. What we saw in the Democratic debates is that the conversation is now between a single payer system, kind of Medicare for all, that you saw people like Bernie Sanders and Liz Warren promoting, to something that was like what Joe Biden pushed, like a public option, which still means that there's it's not a full blown single payer system, but still meaning that people have the option of being part of a federal health program if they want to, and it's far to the left of what we were talking about. So, you know, what worries me is I tend to sort of just, without taking a position on what's the right and wrong thing, I'm always curious on what's the likely political reaction. How's America going to react? And for me, one of the real lessons of 2010 was that the Republicans were able to capture enormous public anger. Even if you view Obamacare as in many ways this compromise, it was still very much painted and presented as something that was to the left, that was going to involve government too much in people's healthcare. And it was successful. The Tea Party, you know, really grew on the back of it. We saw the Republicans take back the Senate and the House in 2010 on the back of that. And I expect that if the Democrats win the White House and win the Senate, and they push for some version of Medicare for all or a public option, that they're going to encounter that same reaction from suburban swing voters, from moderates. And they're also going to be facing the same kind of the pressures of all these other stakeholders, the employers, the large and small businesses, the insurance companies, the pharmaceuticals. And I think we could easily see a replay of a very progressive law followed by a very negative public reaction. So, you know, selfishly, like I tend to, most of my work is on behalf of providers, and I want to see a system that creates stability and growth. And I think we may get more drama and leaving people in a difficult position to navigate.
You talked about at the beginning the financial cost of healthcare in the U.S. How do you see the financial pressures playing out?
I feel like it's dangerous to talk about politics because it's a lot of predictions. The one thing that I feel more confident about than anything is that the financial pressure to change is going to be a dominant driver. Because it doesn't matter what side you're on. We have a real problem. We have an aging population with significant rising costs of healthcare just as a result of that function. And we're currently at a national healthcare spend of $1.2 trillion, increasing by 4 to 5% annually, reflecting 18% of gross domestic product and climbing. And what's happening is, if you look at what's happening to the federal budget, is that entitlement spending, federal health program spending, Medicare, Medicaid, TRICARE, all the various programs are crowding out all other sources of spending. So what it means is we're getting closer and closer to a point, to a crisis point, when the likeliest outcome is that there will be some attempt to cap federal spending and to find a way to shift the risk from off of the federal government's back towards some other entities willing to accept it, right? We've been talking for a long time about shifting risk to providers and to payers. That's a lot of the Affordable Care Act had mechanisms like accountable care organizations and other bundled payment mechanisms to try to do that. And I think the long-term inevitability is that we're going to see a risk shifting, some kind of risk shifting, right? We're seeing a lot of the large payers and providers kind of blend together in ways to operate. And I think that to me is the biggest, the safest prediction about the future of healthcare, is that it's going to be a system in which risk is delegated. And that has really important implications for behavioral health, because it means that there's going to be less and less space for people to operate in a silo, just independently and not contracted and connected to other units. It's going to make it much more important to be able to be part of networks and to participate with in managed care. And so I think it's something that it's not here yet, but I would predict that by 2028, these financial pressures are going to come to a head. I use that year because a lot of the debt that was taken on to get us out of the 2008 crisis is going to come due in 2028. And I suspect that a lot of the debt that we're taking on now in the COVID pandemic is also going to, we're going to start seeing that in that same time period in the late 2020s.
How do you see that impacting the consumer? Because I would think that specifically in behavioral health, when I think about it from the perspective of seniors or individuals with autism, I would think that this delegation, this working together, and the prohibition of being a silo, being an effective silo, actually benefits the consumer in terms of outcomes. How do you think that plays out for them?
It's interesting. I think that, it really depends. I mean, the experience is very, very different for consumers depending on what part of the system you're in, right? So if you're here in California, for example, 35% of the population, we're moving towards 40%, are now part of the Medicaid program. So that we're seeing like these managed care public systems, if you fit within them, if you talk to people who are part of Medicaid, they're thrilled with it, right? For everybody else, whether you're talking about the working class that have to fend for themselves in healthcare, or for people who are employed more affluent people, there's a clear shifting of cost to the consumer. So so it's funny. The one of the big overarching trends in healthcare has been this shift to more of a consumer-centric system, meeting consumer expectations. And I think that trend is expanding in all the places where consumers have a lot of power. And I think we're going to end up with a system that has some kind of public system that is not going to be as consumer friendly. But we're seeing all over that where there are things that, where there are attractive pockets of reimbursement, providers are going to have to adapt and compete in a much more consumer-centric market, creating a consumer experience that matches what we've come to expect with regard to everything else, with regard to shopping on Amazon or on the web, with regard to how we consume television and video on Netflix and other services. We're going to see the people who are able to really engage consumers and kind of meet the moment are going to be the winners. And I think it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out in this kind of split of our system into a high-end system where people are paying out of pocket, and in the public system.
I had an interesting conversation the other day with a woman who worked in healthcare. I mean, she comes from a totally different world. She comes from working in the White House, but she was just talking about the customer experience and how she piloted a program in Switzerland for kids who had serious cardiac issues, which was kind of a, you know, very consumer-friendly experience. There was no check-in process. There was no waiting in line. You know, kind of all the paperwork was done behind the scenes. Parents could be in the room with their kids when they were in intensive care. And she talked about how families would come from outside Europe to do it, but they couldn't get families within Europe to buy that experience, that they would rather send their kids to America. But it just was interesting to see that example. And we're now starting to see doctor's offices where there's no waiting. You know, they're trying to change the entire consumer experience as opposed to the typical, you go to your doctor and you can wait for hours, right, to be seen.
Oh, yeah. No, I think it's really interesting. We see this breaking out all over. I mean, if you talk to people who are in leadership roles at the health systems, you see them worrying about this issue, about how they can adapt. We're seeing lots of examples of new entries into the market. The one that just happened in the last month that I'm really interested in is this Oak Tree Health, which is really trying to bring consumer-friendly care into senior, you know, into the senior primary care market. And so I think we've been seeing those things happen. I think it's going to be a real pressure point. And I think, you know, in terms of thinking about who are going to be the winners and losers, I would bet on the companies that are most able to adapt to this environment. I think, you know, really figuring out how to meet patients and really hit that level of engagement. I think that's going to be maybe the most important factor ahead in terms of who wins and who loses.
What about science and technology? You know, generally, technology has not done a great job, right, in healthcare. If you look at our system, it's pretty archaic. Even in terms of if you have multiple doctors, just the lack of integration between doctors and communication and care. But how do you think, you know, COVID-19 has accelerated that immensely with telehealth?
I think it's an interesting question. So I would break science and technology into two pieces. So first of all, I think what you're alluding to is, yeah, we've had an incredibly fragmented system where we haven't had interoperable health records. And, you know, frankly, we've seen the health data emerge in a way where it still remains incredibly siloed. You know, you have healthcare organizations spending staggering sums to manage data on systems like on Epic and other systems. It hasn't been a great record for that technology with respect to data and integrating, helping providers integrate. It's been just the opposite, right? I think technology, we are seeing some breakthrough uses of technology, right? We've been talking about when telehealth was going to hit its moment for well over a decade now. And I really think COVID-19 impact on telehealth has been, you know, it's hard to overstate it. I saw one report from McKinsey that said it went from what was expected to be a $3 billion opportunity to an $80 billion opportunity over the next couple years. And we saw that, you know, immediately doctors didn't want to be in the same place, or other providers didn't want to be in the same place with patients, and vice versa. You know, people needed to get care remotely, and we forced a huge part of the patient population and doctor population into the model. But my expectation is that we're going to stay there, right? Medicare, for until pre-COVID, Medicare only allowed telehealth to be used in rural settings when doctors were genuinely far from patients, and now it's widely used, and I think it's going to be hard to take that away. Likewise, we're seeing digital therapeutics, you know, the opportunity to use apps and other kinds of software approaches to either support or enhance healthcare. So I think the technology piece is advanced dramatically. I'm excited about it from the standpoint of getting more access to care at lower cost. The science piece is really fascinating and really different. To me, the most dramatic advances we're making in healthcare are these scientific changes. You know, all of these new drugs, devices, and therapeutics that are coming out, dramatically different understandings of disease process in the human body and the brain and the microbiome. And I and the question is, you know, it's a real challenge because we're talking about competition over a limiting dollar. You know, we already have so many forces in healthcare competing for it, but the science and technology is going to demand more money. So it's really a big question to me how we're going to take full advantage of that innovation. It's one place where the United States is still clearly a leader in the world, in spite of everything else we can say about our system that doesn't work, and how we're able to actually develop and apply that those scientific advances in the coming years are going to be important questions. We may be on the verge of a really different, you know, we've made enormous advances in immuno-oncology on the cancer front. I think I don't think we're far off from significant advances on dementia and Alzheimer's. I mean, we're seeing really dramatic, you know, opportunities, but they're going to come also at enormous cost. So it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out.
And shifting to social expectations, I mean, how do you see expectations around healthcare changing?
You know, this is an interesting, I was thinking about this. I think it's kind of related to the political question, but a little bit different. And that's the question of what people expect our health system to do. You could argue that part of the political difference is differences in how that question is answered by people in different political parties or parts of the country. But it's striking to me that, like, if you go back 5 decades ago to when we enacted Medicare, I mean, it was not before 1965 that we felt that seniors, we had a moral obligation to provide care for seniors. Until that time, we really largely expected either people's children and families to bear the care of senior needs or charity care. You know, it's only, we talked at the beginning of this a podcast about mental health parity and coverage for behavioral health as a brand new issue. And so I think, you know, we've seen in the last couple of months, even COVID-19 has really dramatically shifted where our priorities are. So I think there's a really interesting question of what everyone's entitled to, you know, versus where government is going too far in terms of managing our health. One of the areas that we identified when you try to figure out why Americans are less healthy, why we live shorter lives with much more disease than places around the world, have to do with, you know, our view of what government is entitled and society can impose on us in terms of how much we eat, how we manage our weight, you know, how managing hypertension and stress. And I think there's some fascinating questions that, you know, and when you look at the divide, the political divides, it's not just a question of, you know, of how we fix healthcare, but it's also what we expect government to pay for. This underlying societal expectation and these kind of social tensions and, you know, how they shape the conversation is, I think, is going to be a really important question. I think, you know, there's lots of places. There's no shortage of places where we can put money in, but how we make those choices, what we say people need to pay for out of pocket, are going to really be maybe the most important part of the conversation in terms of how our system changes.
When you were talking about, you know, history, it's only been 50 years. It's only been a little less than 50 years that individuals with disabilities have been entitled to a public education. Before then, you know, they weren't attending schools. You know, we're talking late 60s, 1974, when that act came into place. And we just celebrated the 30th anniversary of the American with Disabilities Act. So a lot of that has been recent history. And now, of course, we're looking at, with the shift in COVID to telehealth and to a lot of reliance on technology, we're looking at how poorly technology serves people with disabilities and the lack of accessibility around technology. So these are all really interesting conversations.
Yeah, 100%. No, I think the questions around how we serve people with disabilities are huge questions. And they're questions about which we're really divided. And so, you know, who wins and who loses in those conversations is going to have a huge impact in the future of our system.
Well, Harry, you've provided us so much food for thought on these five areas. Thank you. I look forward to welcoming you back for part two, where we dive into how this all impacts behavioral health.
Thanks for listening to the Illuminaire podcast with Dr. Renit Molko. If you like what you heard today, please subscribe, rate, review, and share our show with other listeners. See you next week.